I started to say that, that by 60 I started to get offers for university jobs and was really just didn't find them terribly interesting. By 61, when the Kennedy administration started, I was very interested in being part of that. And so a friend of mine had a job at a place called the Institute for Defense Analyses, which was a think tank for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, as RAND was for the Air Force. And he encouraged me to come down, and I was very interested in that. Institute for Defense Analyses, IDA. And I moved on down to Washington with, let's see, we had two little kids and one in the oven at the time. Moved down in June of 1961. And that was a very exciting time. Did you want to carry on from there?
Well, let's just back up on your family life because we really didn't... how you met Dolores and all.
In the early 50s, about 54 or so, I was on a trip to Boston and called a friend of mine, telling him I was coming in. And it turned out that this friend was engaged to one of Dolores's roommates. So he said, "How'd you like to come out with my fiancé and her roommate?" I said, "Sure, that'd be great." So we went out, and that was really a very pleasant, delightful evening. But, you know, she was in Boston, I was in Buffalo. And on subsequent trips to Boston, which occurred every year or two, we got together. But there was not much to it. Then when I was in graduate school, in about 56, or the summer of 57, turned out that Dolores was working down in New Jersey at Fort Dix, and I was in Washington that summer working with the Navy. And so that was, rather than 12-hour drive away, that was like a 3-hour drive away. So we spent a lot of weekends together. Then it turned out that Dolores was going to be transferred out of there, and she had a choice of being transferred to Syracuse or some remote place. And so she chose to go to Syracuse. Well, we were now only an hour away because I was in Ithaca, which was about an hour from Syracuse. So we ended up getting together every weekend. And ended up, I think, in November, deciding we were going to get married. And by January of what was then 58, we got married. We went off skiing in New England and Canada. I had one of these great cars. It was a 1953 Packard convertible. Great big red leather seats, and when Dolores drove it, you couldn't see her head above the top of the seat. And so during the winter, she drove that car back and forth to Syracuse. We rendezvoused at my apartment in Ithaca, and come June, I finished my exams and was leaving school, and I was going back to Buffalo. With my 2 weeks of vacation a year. So before I got into that, we decided that we really ought to take a last fling vacation. And so the two of us got we got a $1,000 ticket from New York to Rome that allowed, SAS was having a great sale, that allowed us to stop wherever we wanted on the way to Rome. And then on the way back, so we started, we flew from New York to Copenhagen, went to Stockholm and bought all our furniture. We had no furniture at the time because I had a furnished apartment in Ithaca, and stopped in Germany and in Switzerland and Italy and France, and then took a side trip off to Spain to see Dolores's uncle. Dolores's father was from Spain.
What was Dolores's name?
Dolores Reguera.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly, R-E-G-U-E-R-A.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was Spanish. Her mother was Jewish. She, too, had been the child of a divorced couple. Her parents broke up when she was about one also. So both of us came to recognize that we had been through that similar, rather stressful experience as kids. We've talked about it, that those were probably high risk. We were both probably at high risk for failed marriage, given our parents having broken up, but we recently celebrated our 41st anniversary.
Where were you married?
We were married in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
In January. It was a rainy night that turned to snow, and I picked her up, not at her home, and somewhere in Syracuse, I guess. A cop stopped me on the way. He said, "What's your rush?" I told him I was going off to be married, and so that seemed to work. One of those times when it really was the truth. So we drove to Boston, and her sister had arranged most of the arrangements in a
mm-hmm.
hotel in Boston, and had found the rabbi, and my family came up mostly from New York. Her family's in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and we must have had, some friends from Ithaca came, and it was really very delightful. We had arranged to drive up to Quebec. My Packard ran
uh-huh.
into a snow plow and got a little bit of fender crinkle. It was built like a battleship. And I had been to Quebec some years earlier and had told her that I had found this lovely hotel called the Chateau Frontenac, which was obviously mobbed in the summer,
uh-huh.
but we were going to have no trouble in the winter. We showed up at Quebec. And it's sort of the story of our traveling life. We made no reservations, of course. We stopped at a motel on the way in Maine, showed up in Quebec, and asked for a room. And, of course, the desk clerk laughed. It was Winter Carnival. There were no rooms to be had in Quebec whatsoever. And we ended up in a place that had one of these long cords with a bare light bulb that I suspect was used for other purposes other than Winter Carnival. But we got a kick out of it and worked fine. We spent a few days in Quebec, then moved up into the Laurentians and went skiing up there, then came back to Albany, and Whiteface had just opened, went skiing there, and worked our way back to Ithaca. Just before classes started in early February.
Sounds lovely. Okay, so then you a later honeymoon.
Well, that was our honeymoon.
Mm-hmm.
But then we took the 6-week trip through Europe.
In the summer.
In the summer.
The following summer, okay.
Because I had just finished exams and while we had a great time going marching through markets. We both enjoyed markets. And then when we were in Rome, Dolores was having trouble wandering through the markets. And it turned out that we decided we'd better check with the doctor. And sure enough, Dolores was pregnant with our first daughter. She was rather concerned because her sister had had a miscarriage, so she was afraid she was going to have to go home and bed rest or something. And the doctor said, "Don't worry, just don't jump." So we finished our trip through the rest of Europe and came back. And
you started saying in Spain you saw some of her family?
That's right. Dolores' uncle, Mariano, what was there and a number of his kids. And none of them spoke any English. Dolores spoke some Spanish, and I had some French, high school French. And so we communicate with some of the kids in French and some of the kids in Spanish. And it was a very pleasant visit.
What was your uncle's name?
Uncle Mariano. And that they're gone now. But it was my introduction to the Spanish family.
Mm-hmm.
That this was before refrigerators were prevalent in Spain, and so they had servants, and the servants would go down for every meal and buy whatever food they needed. We talked about refrigerator. I remember them saying that they'd much rather have a servant than a refrigerator. Appliances have been the bane of the efficiency. So we spent about a week in Spain, and then moved on up to Paris and London and back home. So it was a rather exciting trip, Frommer had just come out with his Europe on $5 a day at the time, and so we used it rather well. And when we came back, we calculated our expenses, and we got by on Europe on $2.20 a day.
You're kidding.
Stopping at tourist offices, at railroad stations, and airports, finding our room, and they were always very nice. The only handicap was that we rarely had a toilet and a bath in the room, but other than that, Europe was just so much cheaper than it is today. That was in 1950, summer of 58. And so we moved back to Buffalo at that point. We had no furniture. I guess we had bought a bed, and then we went to an auction and got two bridge tables for 50 cents each. And we had this little garden apartment in a housing complex in Buffalo, outside of Buffalo. There was an overhead light in the dining room. So one was our kitchen, our eating table, and the other was my desk. And somebody had told us that they're really strange people who moved into this apartment. They sit and eat in their dining room all the time. But we had a bed and a vacuum cleaner, and then about 2 months later, all of our furniture arrived from Sweden. And so we were finally furnished in a well-furnished house with furniture that was really quite nice,
mm-hmm.
for the time.
And you mentioned that Dolores was pregnant, so...
So she was pregnant.
Uh-huh.
She had been working at... Her training was in biology.
Mm-hmm.
She worked in biology for a while, didn't particularly like that, and ended up being recruited by RAND, which was then doing a massive project of staffing for the installation of a North American defense computer network. They were doing it in New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
Then they moved her to Syracuse. But by the time we got to Buffalo, she was there wasn't much point in taking on a new job. She was going to be having the baby. And so Lisa was born at that time.
And when was her birth date?
Her birth date was in January. In February.
1959.
February of 59. Ellen was born in May of 1960, and Diane was born in September of 1961.
Ellen, say, repeat Ellen.
Ellen in May of 1960, and Diane, this was just prior to technology. None of these were carefully thought through and planned.
Diane in when?
In September of 1961. So there were basically 15-month intervals.
Wow.
And in June of 61 is when we moved to Washington. And we had this this non-air-conditioned house. It was a brand-new, lovely house in McLean, Virginia, that we were renting.
June of 61.
June of 61, we moved to Washington. And so Dolores was about 6 months pregnant with two older sisters in diapers. So when Diane was born, we decided that what we really ought to do is get a live-in housekeeper. We weren't near a bus line or anything, so it ought to be someone who lived in with us. So we hired a girl who stayed with us, and this was our first time in the house. All we had was this garden apartment, and she was around us in the evenings. She didn't have any kids to deal with, so we decided our solution to avoiding her intruding on our privacy was that we bought our first TV set at that point. So Annie was able to watch. She would sit around reading True Confessions and other stuff. So that was when we got our first TV set. It was a black and white VHF only set, and that was the TV set that we lived with until our kids went off to college.
You're kidding.
This was largely strategic. And once our kids were gone, we then became decadent, as the kids told us, and got our first color TV and started to live it up.
What year was that?
Let's see, probably in about 1980 or thereabouts.
Did you help much with the kids? So, you know, when there were three so close, or is that one of the reasons why you wanted to?
Well, I was still very much working full time, I think it's fair to say that Dolores carried the big burden of it. She was not working outside the home, and I came home every night and wasn't doing a lot of traveling at the time. It is the case that, let's see, we moved in June of 1961, and then I went off on a 2 or 3 week business trip, and I think I spent a good amount of time with the kids. I'm not sure how helpful I was. Dolores was the diaper changer and the feeder and so on, but I certainly was part of the bringing up process, I think they were very close and ran out of arms, so that there were the three of us. And let's see, in September of 1962, Diane was about a year old. I was sent off to Vietnam for 3 months as part of a project. And by that time, we had moved into a house in Bethesda. We were renting this house in McLean for a year and decided we ought to own a house. And so we bought a house in Bethesda that was on a cul-de-sac, and it was really a great arrangement because not a lot of traffic. Virtually all the mothers were home. Virtually all the kids were sort of very young, and so it was a real community, and that just worked out very well.
When did you buy the house?
When?
What year?
We moved in 61, so we bought it in 62.
So you went on a trip to Vietnam in 61?
In 62.
Oh, okay.
When Diane was about a year old, and the Vietnam was It was still before the war had escalated, and they wanted a team. Defense Department wanted a team out there to figure out what research R&D could do about dealing with a guerrilla warfare issue, and Vietnam was an interesting situation at the time. Khrushchev, in I think January of 61, had said Korea has proven that we know that nuclear war is a stalemate. Korea proved that limited war was a stalemate. The way the communist world will win is through wars of national liberation. And so this was the last line of defense, in effect. If we could show them that they can't win through wars of national liberation, that then there would be stability in the encroaching of imperial communism. So here was a major issue. I had been working on what was then called counterinsurgency, dealing with issues of guerrilla warfare and wars of national liberation. In fact, this 2 or 3 week trip that I took, what was we had two teams going around the world, one going east, the other going west, and I was in the team that went to Hawaii and the Philippines and Thailand and Vietnam. The team was led by a Nobel laureate in physics, a man named Luis Alvarez.
Oh, great name.
And it was a team of really distinguished folks. And the two junior people in it were a young economist named Dan Ellsberg, and myself.
Later of the Pentagon Papers.
Later of the Pentagon Papers. And Dan and I became very close at the time because everyone else was really a very senior guy. I was 30. This was in 61. I was 31. Dan was about the same age. So we had lots of our own discussions, but also interacted rather well with other members. There was a man named Bill McLean who was really the genius behind the infrared missiles, so it was a very exciting opportunity. We got to. And here was Dan, by the way, had been a student of Henry Kissinger's. And so Dan was thinking much more strategically about lots of issues. And the whole trip had a lot of strategic content. So it was a very interesting and important opportunity to see issues at both the ground level as well as the strategic policy level. So I had gotten involved in those issues, and so I was the natural one to be sent out there for part of this team. So left Dolores with her three babies in diapers. By this time, Annie was gone, by the way. We just had her for 3 months, and we felt we could do fine without her. And I came back, and everyone was curious about who this new man was, and our baby Diane, who was a year old, I remember I was shaving, had my face full of shaving cream, and Diane came in and saw this and just burst out crying about this monster who was invading her home.
You were interested strategically in Vietnam and in other places. As we're sitting here in your living room today, there's fighting in Kosovo. And do you see any? This is now 30. We're leaping 38 years or so. But do you see any thoughts similar or different, or have we learned?
Vietnam was a. There was the hope in Vietnam that we could stop it. And if we could stop it, then we were there. One of the things that happened, I got back and continued to do a variety of studies in the Vietnam insurgency, and came to realize that everything we did, they were matching. And over a period of time, it was clear that we either had to get out or had to do something decisive if we could. And I remember sending a note over to the Pentagon on that, and they said, "What are you doing examining these issues? This is not your business." Which gave rise to a whole sequence of other professional activities. Kosovo is now a month old.
Mm-hmm.
It was the futility over 5 or more years in Vietnam that really started with an advisory role in the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
escalated with Johnson's election, after Johnson's election in 65, and continued dragging on and on and on. I can't conceive that Kosovo would last anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But one can easily see the possibility that we could get dragged into it, because it's another of those wars with profound restraint,
mm-hmm.
Because we don't want to send ground troops in. If we could do something decisive, and it's not clear that we can, but if we could do something decisive, I think it's important to do so. There's no question in my mind that Kosovo can't last for years and years in the same way that Vietnam lasted. But part of what made Vietnam generated so intense a political reaction to Vietnam was a draft, people getting killed, which is undoubtedly a concern that is forcing Kosovo to be such an immaculate intervention. We don't want people to get killed. We don't want to have to mobilize a draft and do all the things that would engender the political opposition to it. So there are similarities, but there's also the Munich similarity about letting a clearly evil guy get away with genocide.
You saw things when you went into Vietnam in 61 that you saw so clearly. Why?
I had a very interesting,
yeah.
While I was there, this was fall of 62,
mm-hmm.
had a very interesting conversation with in a restaurant with some people from the military. One of my observations was, you know, from the viewpoint of the government of Vietnam, the worst thing that can happen is that they lose this war. Second worst thing that can happen is that they win this war. It was clearly in their interest that the thing drag on, because there was lots of American resources pumped into the country, building the country, building the economy, strengthening their power, and so there was a real perverse interest. That this was when Ngo Dinh Diem was the ruler. And just before I left Vietnam, I had a call from his brother, Ngo Dinh Nu, who was sort of seen as part of the intellectual power behind the throne. I had a call from his office. They wanted me to go over and meet with him. I had become friends with one of his advisors. And I guess the advisor had said, this guy has some useful thoughts, or it can be a vehicle for sending thoughts back to Washington. And so we had about a two-hour conversation. It turns out that I had permission from the powers that be at the office I was in to go over and see him, but the Pentagon didn't like that. So I was taken off the project that I was on, and that's what gave rise to my going off for a year's leave of absence at Cornell teaching at Cornell in 1963.
Oh, and what did you teach?
I taught in the industrial engineering department,
uh-huh.
taught a course in operations research, and taught a course in a project course. One of the students in the project course now happens to be the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Lou Platt.
Uh-huh.
And it was a very interesting experience. I taught for that year, and Cornell was a wonderful place to be as a student.
Mm-hmm.
Ithaca was a great place, isolated. My experience as a professional made it a terrible place to be. It was very isolated, very parochial. So I concluded that wasn't a place I wanted to spend my time, and so went back to Washington the following year, after that year there. So,